Good evening. Welcome everyone to tonight's edition of our Dallas. Test.
It's working.
Okay. Welcome everyone to tonight's edition of our Dallas Philosophers Forum lecture series. Most of you are familiar faces, but I know there's probably a few new ones, so I'll spend just a brief minute on our ground rules. We are a nonprofit, all-volunteer organization, but we do have certain expenses to cover. To defray those, we take up a collection of $5 per head per event. And Mr. Carl Meisenbach over here on the end of this table will take the contribution on the way out if you did manage to stop by on the way in. And if you decide you want to be a long-timer, we offer a six-month subscription for $35, which is a substantial discount. So if you want to sign up for that this evening, that'd be great, too. And we allow about 45 minutes to an hour for the lecture, and then we have about 30 minutes of Q&A after that. So please hold your questions to the end of the presentation, and then you'll be recognized one at a time. And please state your question succinctly. We're really not looking for debate or refutation so much as we are questions directed at the speaker that the speaker can pose an answer to. And we'll try to limit everybody to one question until everybody has a chance, and then maybe we can have time to go back for seconds. I was asked to announce an event from one of our participants for kind of a kindred spirit type group. If any of you are interested, there's something called the Metroplex Breakfast Dialogues that takes place on the second Friday of each month at Canyon Creek Country Club in Richardson. And it says it is open to all ages and genders, with active retirees being the largest group of regular attendees, and that it started as a group of people from about 10 congregations and has expanded to participants from over 20 faith communities. Even though it meets regularly as an informal group with no dues, no budget, and so it's a free lecture with a breakfast buffet available. So if you're interested in that, see me afterwards and I'll share this contact info with you. So on to tonight's pleasures. We have with us Dr. Paul Benson from Mountain View College, who has been a longtime lecturer there in the humanities curriculum, and he will be speaking to us on the topic America's Gold Obsession, from the Cross of Gold to the Yellow Brick Road. Dr. Benson.
Thank you very much. Can you hear me in the back? It's a real honor to be here. I thought I wouldn't know anyone. It turns out I know about half a dozen of you, and thank you all for coming. This topic is a huge topic, and so I'm going to go pretty fast, but feel free to interrupt and ask a question about what I've said, and then we'll come back to the larger questions at the end. Now, I had an epiphany event. It happened on January 1st, 2000. Now, you might remember that most infamous of terms, Y2K. Does anybody here remember Y2K? Yeah, well, for about 4 to 5 years before the year 2000, Y2K was constantly on people's lips, and they were talking about it, and disaster was coming. And I thought that night when I went to bed, tomorrow will be the beginning of the 20th century. And so I thought, I'll go down to 7-Eleven and get a newspaper. And I'm sure there'll be all kinds of Y2K things. Of course, I went down to 7-Eleven and got a newspaper. There was nothing about Y2K. I haven't heard the term Y2K in 12 years. It's just like it disappeared off the face of the earth. This is a metaphor, though, for American obsessions. We get totally obsessed about these things. And then all of a sudden, oops, and nobody talks about it anymore. Well, that morning, I was reading the paper, looking for the Y2K, and all of a sudden, I opened it up, and there was an entire copy of the January 1st, 1900 Dallas Morning News. They had reprinted the whole thing in the paper, and I thought, wow, this is amazing. I think I'll read about it. And I looked at the first page, and I started to look at articles. And there's all these war articles, war, war, war. And I'm thinking, 1900, war? And I read about something that said, one of the articles said, and Colonel Baden-Powell has been ambushed. It doesn't look good for his unit. And I thought, Baden-Powell, I've heard that name somewhere. It finally hit me, the Boy Scouts. Well, Baden-Powell survived and went and founded in 1907 the Boy Scouts in England, and then, of course, later, the Scouts came here, the United States. And I was reading, and I would read, it would say something like, there would be a byline that would say, Tucker, ID, IT, Tucker, IT. Tucker, IT. There would be someplace else, something, IT, IT, IT. And I could not come to figure out what that was. Then it finally hit me like a ton of bricks. IT, Indian Territory, Oklahoma. Hey, this is 1900 before Oklahoma existed. Well, anyway, all these articles about war were about the Boer War. It was in South Africa. And the Boer War in South Africa was all about the English and the English Empire holding on to the gold. In the 1870s, the British Empire had gone on the gold standard. Of course, you know, anything Britain did, the United States had to do, we had to keep up with Britain. So in 1873, the United States went on the gold standard. This is known as the Crime of 73. And this became, from 1873 until the First World War, this became the most important issue in American politics, was the whole question of the gold standard. You talk about a knockdown, drag-out battle over something. And the idea was, there was all this gold in South Africa, and the English wanted it. Today we fight wars over oil. Today we fight wars over terrorism. We fight wars over this and that and the other thing. But then they were fighting wars over gold. Because gold was what kept the whole thing going. At least they believed so. So the whole concept that you had to have enough gold to back all of the money, this became the driving force, both in England and the United States. I mean, this is why Fort Knox was built, to put all the gold there so that the money would be backed by gold. Now, tonight, what I want to do is I could talk about a lot of things in the gold standard, but I've decided to talk about just two people that illustrate more than any other man the kind of cultural, philosophical, political issues surrounding gold in this country from 1873 until about the First World War. The issue actually continues on into the Depression when Franklin Delano Roosevelt solved the problem. But we'll get to that. We'll get to that. The first person I want to talk to you about is a man you may or may not know. He was born in New York. He lived in a little town called Richburg, New York. Now, he was what we would call today a spoiled little rich kid. This man had a family that had hit the oil in Pennsylvania. You might remember that the oil boom of Pennsylvania was America's first oil boom. And it propelled the career of one John D. Rockefeller and a man that you may have heard of named Flagler. Flagler and Rockefeller were partners. Flagler was the brains, and Rockefeller was the hatchet man. And Flagler dreamed up Standard Oil, the first great corporation. And Flagler was, and Rockefeller, made money beyond imagination. Well, anyway, a guy that made money lived in New York, but he had hit it big in Pennsylvania. He came back to New York, and he had a huge estate. And he had a son named Frank. Now, Frankie gave, he said, Frank, as the kid grew up, you know, got everything he wanted. Kid said, you know, I'm kind of interested in acting, and I'd like to be in plays and so on. Okay, no problem. He built him a theater. He bought the actors and actresses, the sets, the props, everything, built him a beautiful little theater. He said, put on your plays. So the kid started writing plays, and the kid did okay. He was fairly good, but he realized as he grew older that he was never going to be anybody as long as his dad was paying for everything. In other words, he couldn't make it on his own. So at age 32, he decided to move out west, to leave New York, to leave the man, to leave the old man. I mean, this is kind of like Buddha deciding to leave the rich dad, or St. Francis of Assisi to leave the rich dad. He decides he's got to do it on his own, so he moves out west to Dakota Territory. Now, in Dakota Territory, by the way, I forgot to mention, his wife, last name is Gage. Mrs. Gage is his mother-in-law, was a famous suffragette, women's rights. And this is an underlying theme in all the writing and plays of this man. So this man goes out west, and he winds up in Aberdeen, Dakota Territory, 1880. Frontier, crude, rude, brutal, and he hit it at the time of great drought and locusts and all of this. And this profoundly affected him. He also joined the local Episcopal Church. He had been a Methodist, and he sang in a quartet. And one of the sometimes members of the quartet was a man named James Kyle, who was a member of the Populist Party, a United States Senator of the Populist Party. Very rare, very unusual, but from Dakota Territory. And they became very close friends. Now, this is an important thing to remember. So he tried business, and his business went belly up. Then he decided that he could write, so he worked for the local newspaper, and he covered all the local events and so on. But he wasn't making very much money. Times were very, very bad there. So he decided to go back to Chicago and work at the newspaper in Chicago. So he came to Chicago, and there he wrote. And he had some success as a journalist, but he was always interested in plays and stories. So finally, he met a man named Denslow, and he and Denslow cooked up this new idea for a new kind of story, a new children's story that they would then turn into a play. Now, this one play that he wrote has immortalized him in American history and became one of the most famous writers, although, again, his name is not all that well known today. The story he wrote, of course, was The Wizard of Oz. Now, The Wizard of Oz was written by L. Frank Baum. Now, L. Frank Baum, you talk about somebody that's interesting. L. Frank Baum hit the jackpot. He started writing Wizard of Oz stories, and he had dozens of them. And eventually got so rich, he bought a movie company. And the first silent Wizard of Oz was L. Frank Baum's company, which naturally is called the Oz Film Company. Now, here is where gold comes in. Sometimes it takes me a while to get to the subject. Living out west in the Dakota Territory with those poor, struggling farmers and ranchers in the Dust Bowl of that time, he saw suffering. remember, this is a, you know, some rich kid from New York, right? He had never experienced it. This profoundly affected him. And he became a great advocate against gold. Because gold was what was in the East. The great establishment of the gold people were the bankers in New York City who were for gold. Gold standard. And the farmers out west were, of course, couldn't get any money. They didn't have any gold. They were not able to get loans to farm. If you know anything about farming is a system where you borrow the money in the spring and then you pay it back in the fall. I mean, that's still the way it is today. Some of these people are multi-millionaires on paper, but they don't have, you know, they don't really have cash flow except what the bank gives them. Well, that, back in those days, you couldn't borrow any money. And you have all these subsistence farms all over the Middle West and so on. So anyway, Baum, when he wrote The Wizard of Oz, wrote it as an anti-gold tract. Right? Now, I'm not telling you something that I just, that I figured out. This is well known. You can read tomes and studies of this. And they'll take The Wizard of Oz and analyze every smallest little detail. But let me give you a few, all right? First of all, you have, as a heroine, a girl. Now, you think Dorothy. This is not, that. There are not that many teenage girl heroes in literature before Dorothy. There are a few. Alice in Wonderland comes to mind. But there aren't very many. So The Wizard of Oz has a girl hero. And you remember Dorothy wears, in the famous 1939 movie, she wears ruby slippers. But in the original, she wears silver slippers. She is the poster girl for the silver movement. Keep this in mind. So Baum then has, you know, concocts this story. Now, he sets it in Kansas. There's been a lot of speculation. He was never in Kansas. He was in Dakota Territory. You know, but the dust storm and the tornadoes and all of this, they had it up there in Dakota. He experienced it all. He set it in Kansas, I think, for this reason. Kansas was sort of central in America. You know, it's kind of the heartland of America. And who knows what he did this for. But Baum thought and believed that these farmers needed help. But he wasn't a political person. You see, all of this is done some liminally speaking. And he had, for example, let's talk about the Yellow Brick Road. All right. Now, the Yellow Brick Road leads to Oz. Well, the Yellow Brick Road represents the gold standard, of course. And what's Oz? Oz is Washington, D.C. See? So you get to Washington, D.C., and you discover that Washington, D.C. is put together by a wizard. You know, everything happens there is by this wizard who is behind scenes doing, you know, manipulating things, smoke and mirrors, and all of that. And so this was the idea. The idea is that you don't need the gold standard. And then, as you know the story, the scarecrow and the tin man and so on, they all get what they need. And what they need, they all think they need something else, but what they really need are these things that they're given in the end. And it's a very clever idea. But Bob was one of these people, didn't want to get involved, didn't want to have anything to do with that. So people ask him about it, and they say, that's just a children's story, which, of course, is nonsense. There's many, many, many silver references all the way through it. In other words, he had bought into this idea that silver is a metaphor for those people that were against gold, right? You have the so-called silverites, and you have the gold people. Now, let me switch to another man. And then we'd come back to bomb later. Bomb, again, ends his life and spends the rest of his life in California. And just has one hit. You know, he's a one-hit wonder, right? But it's a good one. And he did a lot with it. And gained a kind of immortality, I would say. That's very rare for us. Now, there was another man, and I want to start by telling you about his father. This man's father was from the South, and he had moved to the North before the Civil War. Now, there were a name for these people. They moved to the North, well, even after the Civil War, they were still called butternuts. Do you know what a butternut is? A butternut is a squash that was used to dye, to dye the Confederate soldiers' uniforms. And it was very popular dye in the South. And it was cheap and simple and easy, and it gave you some kind of color. And so these people were called butternuts that had been Southern. During the Civil War, they were called copperheads. Northerners that sympathized with the South, usually because they had Southern connections. I mean, Abraham Lincoln, for example, was a butternut, born in Kentucky, ends up in Illinois. Now, this man had come all the way to Salem, Illinois. Now, I want you to remember the word Salem, Illinois. Not New Salem. New Salem is where Lincoln was. This man was in Salem. He came there, he settled, but did well. He was a lawyer, he was a judge, and he had a son. It's the son we're interested in. So here's another story of a kid who was pretty much a spoiled rich kid. And the same kind of story of somebody that felt he had to get away from his father and from the place where he would always be known as such and such kid. So he decides to move west. He decides to move west to Nebraska, just south of where our friend L. Frank Baum was at about the same time. He decides to move. That's where the frontier was at that time, in the late, in the 1870s and so on. So he moves there, and he settles there, and it wasn't very long. He's a lawyer. He gets involved in politics, and he's elected to Congress. Now, in Congress, he made a tremendous splash. Now, has anybody yet figured out the name of the man from Lincoln, Nebraska, who became almost instantly one of the best-known congressmen in Washington back there in the 1880s and 90s. Anybody want to take a shot of that? His name was William Jennings Bryan. Now, William Jennings Bryan also went out west, also experienced the suffering of the ranchers and the farmers, also saw the misery, also saw they couldn't borrow money, and he became a lifetime enemy of gold. Gold represented the Eastern establishment and was the death knell of these poor, struggling farmers. It was said of William Jennings Bryan that when he spoke, farmers would sob uncontrollably. He touched their heart. Now, we'll tell you about William Jennings Bryan. William Jennings Bryan was the most liberal, what we would say today, socialist politician that reached a high level in American history. He ran for president 3 times on the Democratic ticket. 1896, 1900 and 1908. He ran for president on the Democratic Party. Now, when I say liberal, he makes the people today that call themselves liberal look conservative. Let me explain. William Jennings Bryan's platform was that the government should take over all of the functions that are now done by private companies in terms of transportation. All of the railroads should be owned by the government. All of the, if they had planes, it would be in all the airplanes. All the highways should be owned by the government. Everything that dealt with transportation in the United States down to the local commuter line should be owned by the government. The government should just take it over. See? Everything that we think of as related to the New Deal, you can line out the New Deal point by point by point by point. It all goes back to William Jennings Bryan. He, for example, was the man who pushed through the graduated income tax. He, of course, was able to do it primarily because of the coming of the war, World War I. The graduated income tax was the idea, the fundamental idea of the graduated income tax is that the rich people pay more and the poor people don't pay anything, you see. That was always his, make it good, help the poor people, don't do anything for the rich. I mean, I'm oversimplifying, but that's the essence of it. Now, when he was in Congress, he decided to run for senator, and so he gave his last speech in Congress. And the speech is, of course, an anti-gold speech. And he says, I will not crucify the American worker on a cross of gold. And that phrase, cross of gold, then was attached to William Jennings Bryan from then on. That gold was the thing that was crucifying the poor American working man, the poor American farmer. And this was William Jennings Bryan's, shall we say, legacy, that he was the great defender of what he considered to be the down-and-out classes of people. Now, when he ran for president, he was running against, of course, the Republican Party. And the Republican Party ran on a slogan. I want you to think about this slogan. High tariffs, a full lunch pail, and the gold standard. All right. Now what that means is this. High tariffs means that American business corporations are protected. And this, of course, they were protected in this way, that the South, which produced all that cotton and all that agriculture, that they had to endure high tariffs. And they didn't like that. See, so that's one of the reasons the Solid South always voted for Bryan, is because he was against, of course, high tariffs. The full lunch pail meant that people had enough money to it's actually called a full dinner pail. You know, I'm old enough to remember when we called lunch dinner. Anybody here old enough to do that? Yeah. So they called it a full dinner pail. So a guy goes to work, he has food. He has enough money to have food. And then the gold standard. The gold standard was the elixir, if you will, that kept Republican Party in power for year in and year out, all through this era. Now, William Jennings Bryan, of course, I'm simplifying. He advocated many, many things. But what I'm here tonight to explain is how important it was to him, the gold standard. Now, here are some ironies about his life and his career. He, one of the great, his greatest advocates, was a man named Clarence Darrow. Mm-hmm. Clarence Darrow. Now, Clarence Darrow was a famous child lawyer, and he fought for and was a great advocate of William James Bryan. They eventually split, but for many, many years, they're very close. And this split will come back to haunt William James Bryan. William Jennings Bryan, I lost my train of thought. He was advocating Darrow was advocating all of the things that Bryant was for, and he was very powerful in Chicago. You know, if you can, to this day, if you can bring in Illinois, you can bring in Chicago, you can bring in Illinois, and it's very, very important, right? And so Clarence Darrow is very important in it. Another man who ironically was a great supporter of William Jennings Bryan was named William Randolph Hearst. Right. Now, William Randolph Hearst was a funny, funny situation. He owned the largest gold mine in, at that time, the world, which happened to be in the United States. It was called the Homestake. He owned, personally, the Homestake that pumped out billions and billions of dollars of gold. And yet, when he was an advocate of William Jennings Bryan against the gold standard. Now, in order to understand that, you have to understand that he was so rich, he was beyond worrying about the money side, right? Because he also had received from his father these newspapers, and he built it into a great newspaper chain. And he and a man named Pulitzer were very majorly responsible in New York City for inventing yellow journalism. Now, here's what happened. Hearst had all of this gold. He also had the largest copper mine, but he also had silver, and that's part of this equation. But interestingly enough, the Homestake, this mine he owned up there in Dakota Territory, was a huge conglomeration of many mines that his father, George Hearst, had bought. And there was one mine next to the Homestake that Hearst wanted very much, but he couldn't get hold of it because the owner wouldn't sell it to him. His name was Glover. Now, I'm going to put you right to the floor on this test. Who in the world is George Washington Glover? Now, those of you that have been at my Marion, been at my talks before, you may want to hold in. But I want the rest of you. Have you ever heard this name, George Washington Glover?
So far, I've heard it.
All right. You never get this. This is so wild and crazy, you never get it. Yes.
I know the name, but I can't place
yeah.
it.
Yeah, okay. George Washington Glover, who spent his life as a gold, owning this gold mine out there in Dakota Territory, in the Black Hills, not far from St. Mount Rushmore. Did anybody see the movie National Treasure? National Treasure, which is all about gold, by the way, for the gold standard, in case you didn't know. That all ends there in the Black Hills. Well, because that was the source of all America's gold, right? At that time, it was pumped out. I mean, the Klondike was nothing compared to Homestake, right? Well, anyway, George Washington Glover is the only child of Mary Baker Eddy. Now, you think about the irony of that sometime. This greatest of all spiritualist American. By the way, I'm going to throw in a side that has nothing to do with gold, but this is interesting. The United States is the only country in the history of the world where women have started denominations, or to put it another way, have started religion. Can you name any religion anywhere in the world that was started by a woman outside of the United States? Yes.
I think in England, Methodism has a break-off of
Where are the Wesleys? John Wesley and Charles Wesley and George Wesley.
Women started it.
Well, there is this argument that Susanna Wesley did start the idea of Methodism. Yeah, and we could go into that. By the way, think about this for a while. Susanna Wesley was the 25th child. 25 children. That's how slim her existence in the world is. But then again, all of us shouldn't be here, but we are. That kind of thing. All right, now back to gold, and back to her. So Hearst was a great backer of Wynn Jennings Bryan. So when Wynn Jennings Bryan finally decided not to run in 1904. He should have backed Hearst, because Hearst had backed him. But he didn't like Hearst, because Hearst was what he called a skirt chaser. Remember, Hearst had lived with his mistress up in the castle at San Simeon. Now, who among you has been to San Simeon to see the Hearst castle? Then you can say, you can agree with me, if there was ever a place of just outlandish, over the top, unbelievable excess in Hearst Castle. And yet, Hearst hired this young architecture student out of Berkeley to work on the castle when he started building. That architectural student spent an entire career on that one project. It isn't finished. It did not even begin to finish, right? My favorite Hearst Castle story is the one 1948. Hearst, who is now at that time a pretty old man, is stepping out of his bedroom. And the maid is walking by. And he knew the maid very well. Her name was Sally. And he said, Miss Hearst, can I come and make the bed? Oh, sure, come on in. How you been, Sally? Oh, I'm great. Did you know I'm going on vacation next week? You are. Oh, good. Well, you certainly deserve it. Hard working lady. And I appreciate everything you do. And so you have a good time. Oh, by the way, Sally, where are you going? Well, you know, Mr. Hearst, I go to the Morro Bay Baptist Church down here. And we're going down to Los Angeles to hear a new preacher boy. Oh, okay. Well, not the kind of thing I do. But I'm sure you'll enjoy it. You have a good time. Oh, by the way, what's the name of that preacher boy? His name is Billy Graham, Mr. Hearst. So he said, oh, Graham. Nah, never heard of him. So he walks across to his office. He telegraphs. He taps out himself a two-word message. Puff Graham. That's it. Puff Graham. And the next day, Los Angeles Chronicle, San Francisco Chronicle, all the papers across the United States, Houston Post, front page, Billy Graham, who was in a little tent down there giving sermons, right, to people that would come. He went one day from being the most obscure preacher in the United States to being the most famous. Instantly. Because puff in journalism means build up, make famous, you know. And they did it. That's power. He didn't even know who Graham was. The only reason he did it because he liked Sally. And it was Sally's faith that made the whole thing happen. Okay. But anyway, okay. Now, I want to finish up with, and then we'll get to questions. I want to finish up with Wynn Jennings Bryan. So, he ends up not being president, but he then supports the next famous Democrat run, Woodrow Wilson. He and Woodrow Wilson had a very shaky relationship, but he supported him. And then Woodrow Wilson is elected, and his prize is to become Secretary of State. So here is William Jennings Bryan, Secretary of State of the United States. This was doomed to failure because Wilson was pushing, starting in 1915, 1916, and so on, to get into war. And William Jennings Bryan, remember, he's a pacifist. And he was not for this. So over Wilson's push to get into the war, he quit. And then he became like a famous elder statesman, right? Go around and give speeches. But his story is not over yet. Now we come to 1925, to Dayton, Tennessee, to the most famous trial maybe of the 20th century. Here you have the famous monkey trial, known as the Scopes trial. Now let's analyze this for a minute. Who was Scopes? Scopes was a high school, a substitute high school, he was a PE teacher, that was substitute helping in the biology class. The whole thing was set up by the ACLU to test the Tennessee law on evolution, whether evolution could be taught or not. So Scopes was the guy that they talked into doing it. Now, where was Scopes from? I'll tell you where he's from. He's from Salem, Illinois. Who was his graduation speaker? William Jennings Bryan. Who was his great hero? William Jennings Bryan. Who do they set up as the head of the prosecution against Scopes? William Jennings Bryan. And so you can see the scenario coming. All right? And then who do they hire as defense of Scopes? Lance Darrow. All right? Remember, Darrow and Scopes loved William Jennings Bryan. And he was prosecuting them. Now, here's the reason, by the way, Bryan was definitely against evolution, but today we would call it social Darwinism. He was against the idea of social engineering. He said, this is very dangerous and it's going to cause trouble. And of course, not more than 10 years later, the Nazis were doing all the things that he was afraid of, right? The eugenics and social engineering that was really, really extreme. And that's the kind of thing Bryan had feared, you see. The thing to remember, he may be very, very liberal, but he's also very Christian. He's very concerned about the ethical implications. All right? So he's going to argue. So they all come to Dayton. It's the middle of the summer. It's hot in the place. There's so many people to come to this trial. So they want to see Darrow. And they want to see Darrow, famous lawyer by then, and William Jennings Bryan go at it. Remember, William Jennings Bryan is the most famous orator from his era of history. And he is bigger than big. So the people were out in the lawn. They had to move the court out in the lawn. I mean, it was just an absolute circus, right? So they get started, and they go through. And so it's time for the defense to call witnesses. And this is where Darrow pulls one of the great famous tricks of American jurisprudence. As his star witness, he calls the head of the prosecution, William Jennings Bryan. Nobody in the history of court cases has ever done this, see? But Darrow wanted him to get up there to defend his case against evolution. Well, William Jennings Bryan was a member of the American American Scientific Association. He was a longtime supporter of science. And he basically, they shredded his, Darrow just shredded his whole thing. In other words, it made him look ludicrous. And then as soon as he did that, Clarence Darrow says, thank you very much. He walks up to the judge and says, Judge, we come to believe that our client is guilty. Mr. Scopes here. So we stand at the mercy of the court. So William James Bryan never got a chance to get up and give his big speech that he had been working on and working on. And so they fine him $100. It's paid. The whole thing is over. So this really upset William James Bryan because he didn't get to make the case against Philip Darvish. So he sat in his hotel. That ended on a Tuesday. Sat there. He finished it Sunday morning. Sunday morning, he gets up. He goes to church. He comes back, have lunch. He lays down for a nap and dies. He died in day right there. End of his career. They, of course, they have, congressmen are in state, in the United States Capitol, lay in state, United States Capitol. Not many, right? I mean, that's usually reserved for presidents. So he gets the full enchilada. He gets all the honors in the United States Capitol, and there he's buried at the National Cemetery in Arlington. Okay, now, William James Bryan, in a lot of ways, of course, outlived his time. But William James Bryan never gave up on his ideas for politically the United States. So, when the New Deal comes along, where do they go? They just haul out William James Bryan and call it the New Deal, and a lot of it was enacted. Some of it survived. One thing that did survive was Social Security. William James Bryan was promoting Social Security back in the 1870s. And so forth. All right, now, how far over did I go? Oh, boy.
That's good. Yeah.
So, more or less on time. After that mixed up mess, do you have any questions? Yes, sir.
Well, I'm sorry to disappoint you. I don't have a question.
Oh, okay.
I just want to connect some anecdotes with my life to the theme of your talk.
Oh, good.
Due to the fact that I was a bit negligent during my undergraduate career, I did not go immediately to graduate school. I took a job teaching mathematics at the Peekskill Military Academy.
Ah.
The Peekskill Military Academy had as its most famous alumnus L. Frank Baum. And it also had a few other little historic things, like their little emblem was the oak at which the some of the New York volunteers went to enlist in the Civil War. And as a teacher at a boarding school, I was housed in the dormitory. The dormitory I was housed in was endowed to the school by Chauncey Depew, who was the buddy who was competing all the time with Cornelius Vanderbilt.
Yeah, so that was a moneyed academy that you were...
Well, they were a private school. Yeah. It was not exactly a high-ranking private school when I was there. Military academies don't tend to be.
Yeah. By the way, do you often get asked to go to the Hemingway impersonation events?
Yeah, I get a lot of people who mention that. I think that's pretty competitive.
Well,
I don't think that's
not so much straight on, but from the profile, nailed it. Another famous Chicago man, by the way, Ernest Hemingway. Yes, sir, Bob.
Tell me I'm wrong, but my understanding of the gold standard was designed to prevent deficit spending, because you could not print money that was not backed by gold.
Bingo.
And that's why Roosevelt had to get rid of it in order to put in.
Well, what he did was very clever, in a way. He just froze the price. Now, this would be equivalent to the United States government today saying, you can sell all the oil you want in the United States, but it's capped at $50 a barrel. That'd be the equivalent today. Well, the thing about gold being at $35 an ounce, all the gold people made plenty of money, but everybody knew what the price was. So it took it out, you couldn't speculate on it. See, this is what they were trying to get away from, was speculation. And so the gold standard then, in that sense, did continue until, guess what president ended the gold standard? Richard Nixon. We had the gold standard, $35 an ounce, until, of all people, Richard Nixon. He just, with the stroke of a pen, ended. Right? No, the reason the Western farmers didn't like the gold standard is because they couldn't get the money, see? And they wanted to float the note, so to speak, and then pay for it. And inflation would come up, and then they'd pay for it. And they, you know, actually come out better that way, because, you know, you always have inflation, right? So they borrow, say, $1,000, pay back $1,000 plus interest, but the net would be about equal. So they were for what we'll say a much more liberal loan policy. Now we're in a very liberal loan policy era right now. If you're a bank, you can just go get all the money you want from the United States government, because it's just electronic money, right? So if you need a bunch of money, boom, there you got it. See? What's the interest rate?
Go to work.
What's the interest rate?
Zero.
Zero. What a deal! You got a banker that's charging you zero, and so the banks aren't getting rich? I mean, they got a bank, right? So right now, you don't hear the bankers complain too much on that particular policy. Yes, other questions, please.
What motivated Richard Nixon at the time he did to give up the gold standard?
Well, Nixon is the old a paradox inside a conundrum, you know, all that stuff. Nixon bought the idea that gold was holding back the American economy. No, because, again, as you correctly point out, there's only so much gold. And, of course, try to find out how much gold is in Fort Knox. I double dare you.
Nobody knows.
I mean, most people in the government don't know. And my belief, if you went to Fort Knox and could get in and went into the vault, there'd be a little 3x5 guard that said, I owe you 10 billion bars of gold. Yeah, there's nothing there. Well, there's nothing there. I mean, actually, there is gold there, but I mean, it's not a factor, right? Because we're talking in trillions and trillions, you know, and so on.
Wasn't there a silver dollar
certificate?
Yes. Dollar?
Right. There was the gold certificate, and then there was the silver certificate, and then there was the Federal Reserve note.
Yeah.
Back when there was a silver certificate, I used to be a paper boy when I was a kid, and there was a lady on my paper route. Paper cost 40 cents a week, and I go collect them. Her name is Dorothy, come to me in a minute. Anyway, so she was a very big Reagan, before Reagan was big, and she promoted Reagan, and she eventually became the head of the Denver Mint because of her loyalty and so on. So one day I was looking through my money, and I had a silver certificate, and her name was on it. The lady that was on my paper route. I used to talk to her all the time. You know, name on you. That's pretty amazing. Pretty amazing. Yes.
What was it that Roosevelt...
Okay, hang on. Women first, go ahead.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize when I named my son Brian that we were related to... Of course, my grandmother's name was B-R-Y-A-N.
Uh-huh. So you found there was this connection, huh?
Uh-huh.
Wow, that's amazing. Yeah, we're all, go back far enough, we're related. Yes, go ahead, please.
What did Roosevelt do in 37, then, if it didn't go up to gold standard?
So he froze the price of gold.
Okay, that's when he got 35.
Yeah, so we're still on gold standard at 35 through Nixon, $35 an ounce. Well, Homestake, for example, they made money hand over fist because they could produce it for under $35 an ounce. And because it wasn't a commodity. See, now it's a commodity, and it's gone up as high as $2,000 an ounce recently. But the fact of the matter is that it was always a commodity. It's just that it has this special allure. And I've asked myself the question, why is gold so special? And one answer I've come up with is this. In the Bible, it mentions that the temple was covered in gold. And it tells you, if you read, that David put in 100,000 talents of gold in the temple, covering it, the walls, the ceiling, the whole thing. You know how much a talent is? 75 pounds. He put 100,000, that's 7.5 million pounds of gold. Or if you want to do tons, about
it. Exaggeration.
Yeah, maybe. But I'll tell you what happened. That was, the temple was before Knox. I mean, that's the point. But I'll tell you what happened within 20 years of the time that Solomon's temple was finished. The Egyptian pharaoh just got a huge army, about 100,000 men, and just came over, and they just took it all. They just mined it. And they stripped all the gold. So the gold ended up in. Yeah, that all that David's gold ended up in Egypt, which Egypt, of course, unbelievable amounts of gold there. But I think you're right. I think it is a little exaggeration. But even if it weren't, there was a lot. When you cover, the walls and the floor and the ceiling of the temple, and it's a lot of gold. Yeah. Anything else you want? Yes, sir.
I used to smuggle gold into India. They used to have, you weren't allowed to bring gold into India. And we could get a lot more money for it by bringing it over there than we could get for it here. And I was always wondering, how did that affect, and this was after Nixon, so.
You know, that's a great question. And if you look at the Indian culture there, Man, you think we're
obsessed. Oh, yeah, I know.
All the gold they can get. Mm-hmm. They have to slump the fair with gold, too.
But they had this ban on importing of it. And yeah. I was wondering, were they trying to prop up their economy by doing this?
Yeah, a lot of this is carried over from the British Empire. Because they wanted to keep the gold there. And then the idea, I suppose, had to do with the British need. And then following the Indian need to try to develop self-sufficiency. I mean, with Gandhi and Nehru, you have this theme of self-sufficiency. Well, gold, if you have a lot of gold pouring in, this causes big problems. Let me give you a case in point. Spain. Spain, you go back to, say, about 1600. Spain was the richest country in the world. I mean, they had all the gold just pouring in. What gold destroyed Spain. Spain's not the poorest country in Portugal, India, and in Europe. What happened? The gold happened. Because what happens is, if you have wealth flowing in, you have inflation. And then, you also, people don't work. Because what happens is you have the gold, so instead of producing a chair, you go buy the chair over in this country where it's cheaper. And that's what they did. So they didn't have an industry, they had not developed an industrial base at all. So Spain is way behind. And so Spain, I argue, I don't know if anybody agrees with this, but I argue that Spain was really hurt and in some ways permanently so by all that gold. Because inflation is a killer.
It's so really, this was some kind of Gandhian scheme to keep resources in the country?
Yeah, so, it's not so much keeping the resources in, but the thing is they didn't want, because of the Indian thirst for the gold, they didn't want the money to be sent, overseas so that, they're bringing in the gold, see? Because gold, let's face it, doesn't produce anything. Right? It's just sitting there. And it's, the richest countries are where, goods and services are produced.
Right.
So what's the richest country in Europe? Well, Switzerland. What do they do? Chocolate and cheese and clocks and knives and watches and Rolexes, and so on. Switzerland is not a particularly rich country in natural resources, but it's very rich in human resources. I mean, think about a chocolate bar. It starts in Africa. They bring it all the way to Switzerland. They turn it into a chocolate bar. They send it all the way over to the United States, and you go down to 7-Eleven, and you buy it off the shelf. It's called Nestle's chocolate. You think about where that's come all the way to you, and you think, my goodness. So why don't they just produce the chocolate bars down there next to the trees? Well,
no electricity.
Yeah, and a lot of other things. You see, yes, ma'am.
I've heard that the Wizard of Oz is a mind-controlled Illuminati programming tool. I want to know what interpretation you cited for the meaning of it being it's about gold and silver.
Well, here it is. The Wizard of Oz is actually about a number of things. It's about the American political system, American culture, about many things. But there is some evidence for what you say, and I'll tell you what it is. Baum had been a Methodist, became Episcopal. When he got to Chicago, he became a theosophist. Cool. Now, theosophy, if you want to study something interesting, you take a look at this young lady named Helena Blavatsky. Now, you have never, ever come across anybody like her. And the trouble she caused in the world is beyond measure. But there may very well be theosophical, mystical elements in the Wizard of Oz. Wizard of Oz is very much a reflection in a way of American culture and ideas that were floating through the head of L. Frank Baum when he wrote it. But more important was to tell a compelling story. The silver stuff, this is almost like it's in the air and it's what he's thinking about and so he works it in. But I don't think that was his motivation for doing it.
So is that your personal interpretation or are you...
Well, everything I say is my personal interpretation. There are many people, as I started saying, you can go on the internet, you can find a dozen books, some people that have written about the silver standard and the gold standard and how this relates to L. Frank Baum. Then you can find people that have written against that. And to me, it's interesting because it shows there are certain themes that are very important at certain times in American history. Gold was hugely important for about 50, 60 years. From the 1870s until the 1930s. Would you say gold's important today? Maybe. Yeah. But it's nothing like it was. Nothing like it was. So, yeah, no, this is certainly to illustrate, all of this is to illustrate a point. And the point is that gold had its place, had its time in American political system, American culture, and that time has passed now. Yes, please.
Would you comment on about what you think the impact of us going back on the gold standard today? Is it something that, based on what you said about Spain, would it cause our production and our economy to come to a halt?
I see what you're saying. Again, gold is finite, right? And the American economy is expanding. In huge ways. So you'd have to set the amount of, say, gold, a dollar is worth, one-tenth of 1 ounce. It wouldn't even be that. It'd be down in grams, right? That a dollar is so many grams of gold. You could do it, but it'd be very cumbersome. It'd be very difficult. The United States government would have to collect gold. They'd have to spend tax money to get the gold. They'd have to pay the going rate, which would be then, if the United States went to gold standard, gold all of a sudden, would just, unless they made it illegal to trade it, which is what they probably do.
Was the Nixonian inflation a direct result of going off the gold standard?
Well, that's the enemies, Nixon would certainly say so.
I mean, I remember that, double-digit inflation.
Yeah, they
went
on. Poured, with inflation now and all that stuff, yeah. But I'm not sure that's the case. You can manipulate the money flow in any country to a certain is right now, the American dollar is still seen as having real, real security. So Saudi Arabia right now is buying up all the debt. Remember, it was China for a long time, the Japanese. They were buying up all the American debt through treasuries. Guess who's doing it now? Saudi Arabia. They're just buying like crazy. So somebody believes in it. Somebody believes in the American dollar. Again, it's the concept of safe haven. Of all the currencies in the world, what's the most safest? Well, I don't know if the United States currency is safe, but people believe it is. And of course, in currency, it's all about faith and belief. It's just like religion, right? You got to have faith and belief. Yes, sir. Yeah, please. Go ahead.
The thing about gold is that it gives you a base of consumption. In other words, so what I'm asking is, it's less controllable by the governments, by any government, for any reason, than anything else. And so that's the main argument for it. And would you comment on that?
What I think would be, I think that's true. I think gold would do that. But I think what's more important, vastly more important, is that the government doesn't spend more than it takes in. That's crucial. Now, right now the government's spending a lot more than it's taking in. So why don't we have inflation? Manipulation of the money supply. That's the answer, right? And so we're in a very strange kind of paradigm here. Because you could put America on the gold standard, and it would stabilize things to a certain extent, but it would also slow down. So it depends on where you are. If you're an investment banker, you're against gold. But if you're a banker, you know, an old-time banker, you're for gold. Because investment bankers make a lot of money, you know, on the ability to quickly churn the currency, as it were. I think the real reason you couldn't do it now is the cost of doing it. The cost of gathering up all that debt. It'd just be astronomical. That's a great question. I don't have a complete answer, but I just think cost would prevent it from being impossible. Yes?
I checked before I came with Wikipedia,
mm-hmm.
and I spotted a concept of I think it was an article on the gold standard that pointed out that all the gold ever mined at today's rather inflated price,
mm-hmm.
would be worth about $1.2 trillion.
Yeah. All
our economy, that's all the gold.
Ever. Yeah.
Our economy is a multi-trillion dollar economy in this country alone.
One that got me was somebody said if you took all the gold in the world, you could build the Washington Monument for the first 20 feet. You could fill an Olympic swimming pool is another one I heard. You know. Yeah, in other words.
You, but not much.
Yeah, there's
not enough gold to be a backing for currency.
Well, or
right,
but, yeah,
what we need.
Well, what you do, of course, the only way that would work is you freeze the price of gold.
Well, this problem that the farmers in South Dakota and Kansas had was they couldn't get any money. And the reason they couldn't get any money was because we were on the gold standard.
And there's only so much money.
And there was only so much of it. And you can't inflate that.
Yeah, exactly.
And that is both a positive and a negative for the using gold as a standard for your currency.
Yeah, it depends. It of course completely depends on which side you're on.
Yeah,
but if you're the rancher.
Even if you take the stance of Milton Friedman and Anna Schwartz in Monetary History of the United States, they pointed out that the severity of the Great Depression was directly proportional to how long you stayed on the gold standard.
That's why the gold, the anti-gold people call it the crime of 73, because 73 started the longest depression in American history. You know the expression Great Depression, today mm-hmm. we use it for the 30s. Mm-hmm. That was originally used for the depression that started when we went on the gold standard. 20 years. Longest depression in American history.
That's, yeah, I've heard something about that, but that's good.
So, but again, you could, people argue that there are many issues, you know. Gold is just one of the issues. And personally, I think it's vastly more important that whatever system you're on, that the government, that the intake and the outgo are near, are equal. Otherwise, you...
Over a period of years.
Oh, well.
If you do it on a year-by-year basis, that would be destructive.
Probably. But if you ultimately, I mean, that has to be the goal. That has to be the ideal. And you don't hear, really, too many parties arguing for that. All right, well, we've gone way over time. Yes, Maria?
The reason why in India, like gold, is because it has to do with marriages. In other words, if it married, you had to have gold.
It has so much gold. And they only accepted that if it was a stable, something that they could count on. All right, well, hope I've answered a question or two. Thank you for asking. Thank you.